Hey there, everybody. Ken here from This Show Is So Gay. I am actually traveling in Guatemala this week with a group of students, so I bring to you one of my favorite episodes from the past year. I know that you will enjoy it, so listen in, and we will be back with you next week with more original content here at This Show Is So Gay. Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 302. 302. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, stroll on over to the Facebook. Type in thisshowisogay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. I have said this so many times before, and I'm going to say it again. One of my favorite aspects about doing this show for so long is that I get to talk to all of these singer-songwriters, folks who are using their voice in the most amazing ways, and this week is no exception. This week's guest is Eli Conley. He is a Bay Area-based singer-songwriter whose music and voice, I am telling you right now, listeners, this is a voice with songs that are going to move you. Eli first gained attention in 2011 with his trio Eli Conley and Hip for Squares and their All the Live Long Day EP. In 2013, Eli released At the Seams, his first full-length album and a project completely funded by his fans, which we'll talk about. He contributed his song Pinocchio to Project Believe in Me's nationally distributed CD to combat bullying, and he's been a featured performer at the San Francisco Transgender Pride March. He's going to be touring all over in the next few months, but first, he's taking a few minutes to hang out with us. Eli Conley, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited to have you. We have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
All right.
All right. That's the all right, I'm ready. Well, we start with you as we start with all of our singer-songwriters, all of our musical folks. Why the medium of music to get your voice out there, Eli?
Mm-hmm. You know, I really feel like for me, being a singer-songwriter is a calling in the sense that it's something that I knew from the time I was a little kid I wanted to do, but I think like many creative folks, I was also told as a kid that, you know, that's a fun thing to do, but it's not the thing that is going to be able to support you, so you need to get more serious. So, you know, as a little kid, I told people my dream was to be a psychologist.
Nice.
But I think it's kind of a similar thing, right, about how to get inside people's heads, but in this case, as a musician, I actually get to put a little bit more there. And if I was a psychologist, it would just be about drawing out what's already there.
Can we start saying from here on out, Eli Conley, psychologist on stage?
I'll do my best. I'll make you cry, and then you pay me, you know, $100 at the end, and we're good.
That's fine. Wow, ticket prices have shot up since I've last gone to a show. That's very exciting. What are your earliest musical memories?
Probably the earliest memory I have is one that my mom has told me about, which is why I think of it, is we were in Disneyland, I think.
Okay.
And I was looking up at this tree with all of these lights, and you know, when you're a child, the magic of Disney made me make up a song.
Yeah.
That went, see if I remember. I wish I was a butterfly away up high.
Wow.
I wish I was a light up on that tree. I wish that I was anything that people loved, which now is incredibly bittersweet. The 3-year-old singing that song, but I think my mom was so surprised she made a big deal of it, and that stuck in my mind.
Yeah, I don't want to psychoanalyze those lyrics, but we should talk about that off the air.
All right.
So did you have to go through a process of convincing your family, hey, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to make a go of?
You know, I'm really lucky to have a family that is incredibly supportive of music and was incredibly supportive of me as a kid to get to, you know, sing in choirs and do musical theater and take voice and piano and guitar lessons. I do think there was a moment of adjustment when I shifted from being a full-time employed nonprofit social justice office worker, which I was all about, but it was easier to pay the bills. And for me, what that looked like is not only starting to get more serious about writing and performing and touring, but I started being self-employed as a voice teacher.
Nice.
And I think that was something that, you know, they weren't sure if that was something that was going to be a sustainable lifestyle. And I think, in particular, knowing that I, as a queer and trans person in their generation, probably would have faced an even harder time being able to make a living, and it can certainly be true now as well. They were concerned that those two things together would make my life challenging. But thankfully, after a couple of years, they were able to see that I wasn't out on the street. I was doing okay. So they have been certainly supportive in that way ever since. But, you know, I think they've always been really glad that I'm a musician, which I'm really thankful for.
And don't you feel like after this interview, you can just call home and say, listen, I have now decided I'm a psychologist on stage, and they'll be so happy.
Totally.
They'll be
so
happy.
I'd actually be a little sad, but yeah, I'll tell you a little secret. I'm actually in their living room right now.
What? Is this like an Easter celebration?
We did do a little Easter celebrating, but I actually started my tour last Thursday in D.C., and now I'm taking a break at my parents' house in Virginia before starting off for North Carolina again.
Wow. Should I be concerned that you started the tour last week and you already need a break?
Thankfully, Easter gave us an early break. So
okay, that's okay. That's okay. Well, let's talk about some of your background there. You came out, I read this in an interview. I have to tell you, this is one of the best quotes I've ever read. You came out in your teens. You said this quote, honestly, I think the reason I came out at first was because I wanted my other queer friends who I had a crush on to know that I was someone they could date.
Isn't that why everyone comes out?
No, that's not why everyone comes out, Eli. That's brilliant, though, that you said that.
Well, you know, I think it's funny. I think I was slightly misquoted. It was one particular friend.
Okay.
Not multiple friends. But, yeah, I had one particular friend who I really wanted to know that, you know, I was an option, should they ever assume.
Nice.
When I was a ninth grader. So I just kind of slipped that one in there one day, and, you know, eventually it got spread around. But it was mostly just about, like, hey, can we make out already?
There you go. There you go. That's like the universal coming out story. I also read there was some gay straight alliance drama going on in your life at that time.
It's true. Yeah. So in 2000, I guess it was the year 2000, when I was a freshman in high school in Central Virginia, I went to a school called the Maggie Walker Governor School. And, you know, these bills come up all over the place from time to time, certainly. But at that time, there was a bill in the Virginia General Assembly to block any sexuality-related student clubs, which, you know, obviously they didn't frame as trying to block gay-straight alliances, but that was certainly the purpose. And folks fought back, and actually my dad went and lobbied to the General Assembly, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
It wasn't him single-handedly, but him and a lot of other folks, as well as the students at my high school, including me, who were fighting to be able to have it. Eventually, the bill was not passed, and even at our high school, I remember the assistant principal saying, like, well, we don't have every club. There are kids who wanted to have a burrito club, and we didn't let them do that.
Exactly the same thing. Exactly,
yeah, no.
The same thing.
We're just going to eat gay burritos.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it's a good way to let your other queer friends that you are someone to date and share a burrito with.
Yes, everyone's queer dream.
I guarantee some listener's going to write in and say, that was my queer dream. So I'm excited. I'm excited. I feel like we just cemented one listener. I don't know who it is, but I will let you know. I will let you know. Well, one of my favorite things to talk about is voice. And we get to talk about voice on a number of different levels with you as a singer-songwriter, as an out trans person. You know, there's so many different ways we can go at this. Let's just start with the physical aspect. In your transition, in your journey, your physical voice has changed.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. Yeah, so as your listeners may know, when somebody is transgender and is assigned female at birth, raised as a girl like I was, and decides at some point to take testosterone, which certainly not all trans male folks do, but in my life that was a decision that I made. It's kind of similar to non-trans guys' puberty, except, you know, we do at whatever point in our life we opt to take testosterone. So for me, I was about 20 years old. And my voice went from being this, like, high lyric soprano. I was a classical singer at the time, as well as still doing folk songs and stuff. And it dropped a lot. So I actually went from being kind of the highest typical female voice part, soprano, to the highest typical male voice part, which is tenor, which is great. I'm actually way more employable for choral gigs as a first tenor than I ever was as a first soprano, because there are fewer of us.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, it works. But that process was definitely a time where I had to, you know, negotiate not being able to sing. Basically, there were notes I would try to sing and something completely different would come out. And I've heard singer-songwriter Joe Stevens from Coyote Grace talk about it as, you know, it's like you're going from playing a ukulele to trying to play a guitar the same way. It takes a while to kind of adjust to this new instrument and just figure out, you know, where are the notes? How do I use this? Even though I'm still the same person, I have a different instrument to work with.
Was there an emotional aspect of coping with, hey, my voice is different than it was?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, certainly, especially for me as somebody who was a serious singer, and when my voice was changing, I was in school at Oberlin in Ohio, and so I was taking classical voice lessons and singing in the Renaissance choir. A lot of my identity was bound up in my voice, and even though I didn't like that it caused people to assume that I was a woman, I really liked my voice. It wasn't something that I necessarily was ready to let go of. And at the time, in the year 2000, there wasn't a lot of information on folks who had transitioned and taken testosterone and were still able to sing afterwards. And thankfully now there's more and more of us who are professional singers, who are trans men, who are able to do it. But it was a big leap of faith that thankfully I was able to, with the help of my college voice teacher, land on the other side pretty well. But it's definitely a process. And now, as a voice teacher myself, I work with a lot of trans students, some of whom are negotiating that same change, and it feels like such an honor to get to help folks through that process as gracefully as possible.
I would imagine that triggers a lot of emotions in you as you are helping other people.
You know, I think for me it's just really all about being present for the person and their process.
Yeah.
And it is such a place to be, but just also reassuring folks from personal experience, you know, it might take a year or two, but you will get to a place where your voice will settle, and if you've continued to train it as those changes happen, you'll be really well set up to use your instrument once you actually finally get to a place where you feel like, okay, I know what's going to come out of my mouth on this day.
Yeah. Now, how do you think, on the other side of voice, how do you think all of this has changed your songwriting?
You know, it's a little bit hard to say because I wasn't serious as a songwriter until years after my voice had settled, but, you know, I was certainly writing that whole time. I think it's not so much about the pitch of my voice, it's more just like my experience in the world. As that has shifted, the topics of my songwriting have changed. So when my voice was changing, I was writing a lot about gender and my experience in the world as someone who was often perceived as not necessarily male or female, or people weren't sure how to place me. And there was a time in my life when I identified as genderqueer, so as not a woman or a man, but as another gender. But nowadays, you know, 8 years after transitioning, almost nine, the songs that I write, I find, are less focused on my own personal gender identity, because that feels like something that is not as up for me in the world. I'm pretty solid as a gay man who happens to be trans, but I find that I write a lot more right now about, you know, God and death and love songs for my partner, and I've kind of shifted to these different questions just because that's not the questions that I personally am in at this moment anymore.
Yeah. And let's give a shout-out to Oberlin. I mean, I'm a college professor. Oberlin's right around the corner from where I live. And
that's right.
And you have all of these stories. There was a story just last week we were talking about in class about a trans faculty member being denied tenure in Southeastern Oklahoma State University over her identity as a trans woman. And the importance of being at an educational institution that's supportive, I don't know that we can hype that quite enough.
Absolutely. I think I was super glad to have that. And, you know, actually before I went to Oberlin, this was the days of LiveJournal, so I was connected to a couple of trans folks who are current students there. And I remember asking them, because I knew a number of trans folks online at Oberlin, you know, what percentage of the student body do you think is trans? You know, I think, you know, they said like 0.1%. You're getting a skewed perspective. But it was just good knowing in that there were older folks there who had already kind of walked that path and helped set things up. And certainly, we did a lot of student activism around having access to housing for trans students so they could live with a roommate of whatever gender they wanted, and having more all-gender bathrooms on campus. But a lot of that groundwork by the time I got there in 2004 had already been done.
Nice. Well, I'm sure that you did your part as well.
Did my best.
Did your best. That's all that we ask for, Eli. Again, listeners, we are here with singer-songwriter Eli Conley. Let's talk generally. Before we get into the tour, before we get into some specific music, what would you say generally you are trying to do with your songs?
Mm. Yeah. So this has kind of shifted for me how I think about this in the past year, actually. I think if you'd asked me a year ago, I probably would have just said trying to write songs that folks connect with, which I still agree with. But I went to a songwriting workshop as part of this bigger songwriter retreat in Colorado last year called the Song School. And I went to a workshop taught by Mary Gaucher, who I don't know if you know her, but a wonderful songwriter who is lesbian identified and is originally from Louisiana but is now in Nashville. And she teaches songwriting workshops, and her perspective is really that as songwriters, the work that we do is to write about experiences we've had that are hard and sometimes even traumatic, and, you know, do our own healing through that process, and then in the process of sharing these songs with other people, help our audiences to see themselves reflected and see and hear things that they might not even know that other people experience. And that experience of hearing somebody share these, you know, very deep, vulnerable experiences helps other folks feel more deeply connected to their emotions and also more deeply connected to their community. So it becomes a more community healing process. And I think, you know, that's not to say that every time I write a breakup song or something that, you know, I think it's going to heal the world. But I do think I've had that personal experience certainly with musicians over the years. There's music that I come back to again and again because it has that core emotional truth, I think, from the person that it comes from. And to be able to feel that that is something that someone else has experienced has been really powerful for me as a listener. So I can only hope that that is something that folks also experience when they listen to my own music.
Well, I've been listening to your music for the past couple of weeks, and it's affecting me that way. So we're going to get it out there to even more folks. Which brings us to touring. How do you feel about touring? Is it different for you being up on stage? Is that something you particularly enjoy?
Oh, yes. It's so fun. It is probably, you know, honestly, I love teaching and I love performing, and I think they are very complementary, actually. Because even though, you know, when I'm up on stage, I might not be correcting your notes or whatever, I think ultimately it's kind of similar process for me of sharing what I have to share and hoping that folks take away things that enrich their lives. So, you know, when I'm back home in the Bay Area, I live in Berkeley and I play San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley a lot, Northern California. That's super fun. But being on tour, I get to perform every single night of the week. And it's just such a blast. And I'm traveling right now with my friend Joel Price from Philadelphia playing mandolin and singing background harmonies with me. And it's also just great fun to, you know, be traveling through beautiful areas of the country right now in April and just hanging out, shooting the, I can't say, on the radio in the car, and playing music and having a good time.
Wow. Give me some highlights. What's one of those times you walked off the stage and said, wow, that was an amazing experience?
I'd say just this past weekend on Saturday night, I got to play in my hometown for the second time, which is this small town called Ashland, Virginia, about half an hour north of Richmond. And there's this wonderful listening room venue called the Ashland Coffee and Tea. And I actually have had the privilege of seeing Mary Gaucher there, as well as folks like Chris Smither and songwriters who I really respect. And so getting to play there for the first time last year was incredible, in particular because the room was filled with people who'd known me for my whole life. And a lot of folks who I hadn't seen in 10 years since I went to college and moved away. So a lot of folks who had not seen me since I was out in the world as a man, and that was, you know, my regular life. And I got to do it again this year, and it's just such a pleasure to get to play for folks who, you know, have been family friends, or my fourth grade reading teacher was there. And so that just feels like such a gift.
Yeah.
And kind of on the other end of the spectrum, I think, it's coming up on this tour. We haven't gotten there yet, but last year I got to play in Brooklyn at this event called Queer Country Monthly that's put on by Karen Pittleman of the band Karen and the Sorrows. And to get to play a show with all other queer Americana bands who have, you know, radical social justice politics also just felt like this coming home in a way, even though I'd never been to that bar in Brooklyn. It's kind of the other, those are my two homes in a way. You know, it's like the folks I've always been around in Central Virginia and, you know, the radical queers who are making country music in New York.
And you're headed to Brattleboro, Vermont, which our show does broadcast still on WVEW LP, Brattleboro Community Radio. It's where we started this show,
yes,
Is So Gay, 7-8 years ago. You're going to love Brattleboro.
I'm so excited. I've heard such good things.
You're going to love it. You're going to love it. Well, I was reading one interview, which I actually thought the interview was quite hilarious on a number of different levels. And they put it in the Huffington Post, which was fantastic. And it's about you're traveling to Pittsburgh, right, coming up?
Yep, that's true.
And I have to ask, one of the questions that the interviewer asked you was, well, let me just get your take on it, and not even what your answer to the question was. I'm just curious how you responded to being asked this. The interviewer asked you, you mentioned the epidemic of violence against the trans community, especially trans women of color. How does your music contribute to the cultural shift that's necessary to stop the epidemic? I thought that was a rather intense question and was thinking, well, gosh, is that pressure that you feel to contribute to the cultural shift stopping epidemics?
That's an interesting question. It was certainly an intense question to be asked, but I was actually really grateful for it.
Yeah.
I think it's an important question that, you know, not only I as a trans person, but that all of us are asking ourselves in the LGBT community as well as broader straight non-trans folks. I think the experience of trans women of color and trans and queer people of color, and I'm saying this as a white person, is something that is often vastly overlooked. And there's this idea that, you know, if we have marriage, if we can serve in the military, you know, if we can sort of live the American capitalist dream, that that is the be-all, end-all of LGBT politics. And there's huge, huge sections of our community who are experiencing life in the day-to-day in ways that are extremely difficult, and certainly in particular for trans women, especially low-income trans women, immigrant trans women of color, you know, if you have multiple ways that you are experiencing oppression at the same time, these things are just compounded. And already this year, it's like I'd have to look it up to even know how many people it is. I believe that it's 6 people already this year who are trans women of color have been murdered.
Yeah.
And this is something that, you know, it's almost like, you know, I think it's really important that we have the Transgender Day of Remembrance, but I also think it's become this thing where it's almost like we feel like this is inevitable. It's not something that we can change, and I think that is not true and is really sad. And there are so many folks doing amazing organizing to say this is a cultural shift that is necessary, and we all need to be a part of making change so that not only, you know, normative two white, non-trans, queer people can walk down the street and hold hands and get married, which I want, I absolutely want for me and all and everybody, but also that, you know, the folks who are the most marginalized are the folks who are actually leading this movement, whose needs are the most extreme, shall we say. So, you know, to turn that question back on myself, as a white, owning class trans man, what does it mean for me to be a part of that cultural shift? I think it's really important that for all of us, we look at where we are positioned in our daily lives.
Yeah.
And how can we take action from there. So for me, being a songwriter and a performer, I think it's really important to lift up the voices of trans women of color, lift up that organizing. Like, for example, in the Bay Area, there's the Transgender, Gender Variant, and Intersex Justice Project that is an organization specifically by and for trans women of color who have been incarcerated, who are working to end the prison industrial complex. And they recently had a big die-in on the steps of San Francisco City Hall saying, this can't happen anymore. There's a young woman, Taha De Jesus, who was killed in San Francisco just a couple months ago, and I just really feel personally compelled to be a part of creating a world where folks understand that it's not just, you know, you need to tolerate trans people or you need to, I don't know, be okay with a trans person being the CEO of a company or something,
right.
But what are we actually doing for the folks whose lives are impacted in a daily way by this state violence and also by violence that happens culturally and that is normalized, that it's okay for a trans woman to be killed and there won't be a response.
Right.
So, that's a big, long answer.
No, I love it. And I love hearing about inspired activism. I get worried sometimes that we're just falling into this whole, well, I'll just share a petition on Facebook, which, make no mistake, I did that about 10 minutes ago on some other issue. Very important. It raises awareness, but I want to see that inspired activism out there. So I'm not for whatever triggered what did indeed trigger a die-in, but I love that people are doing some inspired things because there's a lot of change still to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, this is going to be a little bit funny to do with you, particularly given your new title of Psychologist on Stage, but we are going to do with you with what we do with so many of our guests. We're going to do a little self-analysis. I'm going to give you some songs that you have put out there to the world, and you, Eli Conley, are going to tell our listening audience what you think that they say about Eli Conley. You can do it in the third person if you need to.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah, I feel. Okay,
all right.
I'm ready.
Well, first we have to go to, and my gosh, do I love this song, and I've listened to it so many times, and everybody needs to go download it right now. Tell everybody what Pinocchio says about Eli Conley.
Mm-hmm. So Pinocchio is a song I wrote when I was in college, and kind of the chorus of it, if I remember correctly, I haven't sung it in a while, the beginning of it is, "I'm not a real man, I'll tell you why." And so I think kind of what that says about me is I have a sense of humor, but also that kind of these cultural messages, right, that trans people aren't who we say we are negative and hurtful,
yeah.
But also I'm not invested in being a real man. I'm just invested in being who I am, and that, you know, kind of that basic binary idea of male equals masculine, female equals feminine, and nothing in between is not helpful,
right,
for my personal life, even as somebody who's now male identified.
And I would imagine you've gotten amazing responses to that song.
Yeah, a lot of folks really love it, and I feel incredibly honored that folks connect with it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great tune. It's a great tune. And then we'll do one more. We'll make you do one more self-analysis off of the At the Seams album. And this is my favorite one on the album. I enjoy the album, but I particularly enjoy the song Siren Song. What does Siren Song say about Eli Conley?
Huh. That one's harder.
Good.
Because it's not about me. But it is a song about a mythological Greek siren on the cliffs who gets tired of just being, you know, eye candy and decides to move to the city and start her own rock band. So though I am not a rock musician, I would say, you know, maybe it reflects my own personal longing to be up on stage. And I don't know, I wouldn't say not just be eye candy, but have people listen to what I say.
Yeah.
You know, and also just talk to how much fun I feel like it is to get to do what I do and make music and perform.
And to be clear, lest people get confused, you are not charging $100 a session for each individual at these concerts, correct?
Very true. Very true. It is less expensive than therapy by, you know, about 100%.
But possibly more fulfilling, and we're going to find out. We're going to find out. What's one place that you are headed to other than Brattleboro that you've never been that you're so excited to check out?
Yeah, well, you know, in Vermont, I'm really excited to play house concerts in both Burlington and Plainfield.
Awesome.
I have spent a little bit of time in both cities, but I'll be in Burlington on April 19th, which is a Sunday, and then playing at the house of one of my very closest friends in Plainfield on Tuesday, April 21st. So if folks are interested in coming to one of those shows, you can go to my website, and there's email addresses to write the hosts and get their address, because we don't publicize it since it's not a venue. But I'm also really excited to be at the Root Social Justice Center in Brattleboro. I think it'll be a really great time.
Oh, those are some great folks. Some of my oldest friends from living in Brattleboro for so many years. You are just going to have a blast, and they're going to love you. It's through those folks. It's funny. You gave a shout-out in that Huffington Post piece. It was through those folks that are organizing your visit there that also organized My Gay Banjo, and that's how I learned about My Gay Banjo.
Oh, awesome. They are so good. You should totally have them on your show.
I would love to have them on my show. That's going to come up too. But first, we got to talk about you. Listeners, you need to stroll on over to EliConley.com. You can see all of the East Coast tour dates. He's going to be everywhere, although I do not see the Cleveland House concert. Can we get you over to my house?
Maybe next time. That would be fabulous.
All right. We're going to have to organize that. Well, look, I have been listening to your music for the past few weeks. I will say I am particularly obsessed with Pinocchio, and I've had it on repeat, and I actually played it for a group of my students in class, and it facilitated an amazing conversation about identity. So I'm so appreciative for what you're putting out there, and just the notes and the voice and the authenticity. What an absolute treat featuring you.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's really a privilege to get to talk to you, and thank you so much for your research and attentiveness to detail. It's really fun to be doing this interview.
We're going to do it again. EliConley.com. Eli, have so much fun out there on the road. Tell everybody in Brattleboro I say hi.
Will do. Thanks again, Ken.
I am not leaning close, I'll share with you the secret. No one is a real man at all. Pinocchio, you are a boy. Doesn't take no fairy blue, much less a therapist, redactor.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, one of the fun parts about having a radio show in an age where the web is happening is that I get to see an article that catches my attention, reach out to the individual who created said article, and then have them on the show that very same day. Such is what happened today with an article I saw called "Has Gay Panic Ruined Bodybuilding?" And here is the gentleman who created said piece. Adam Ragusea is the journalist in residence and the visiting assistant professor at Mercer University. He frequently reports for NPR, Slate, and other news outlets. He also has hosted his own weekly podcast called The Pub for Current, the public media trade magazine. Previous to that, he was the Macon bureau chief and the Morning Edition host for Georgia Public Broadcasting. And previous to that, he was a reporter, associate producer, and backup host for WBUR, helping to launch Radio Boston. But for right now, he's hanging out with us. Adam, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
I was just thinking, all those entities are so not going to want to be associated with what we're about to talk about.
And yet, it is a resume builder in itself that we have you here.
I know, exactly. Oh, hey, you know, this is the apex right here. Well, you know, I understand that I am your third straight guest on this show. The prior two were Howard Dean and Peter Shumlin.
You are the first straight male non-governor we've had on the show.
Well, the folks in Burlington should just go ahead and start calling me Mr. Governor-elect at this point, I suppose.
I feel like you're going to call home after this interview and say, folks, refer to me only as Governor Ragusea.
That has a ring to it. Almost as good as Governor Schwarzenegger, but we'll get to that later.
We're going to get to it right now. I saw a piece, Adam, called "Has Gay Panic Ruined Bodybuilding?" And not only did I see the piece, but I saw your, I would say, unbridled enthusiasm that you got to write a piece about bodybuilding.
I know. This is, honestly, it's like, this is one of the best things about this life that I lead now. Well, let me back up. So I started, believe it or not, I didn't study journalism in college. I studied music. I was going to be a composer, okay? And I was a terrible student. I mean, I was decent at music, but I was a terrible student. I had a lot of trouble focusing because I have this sort of intellectual promiscuity. It's like serial monogamy.
Got
intellectually.
It.
So like I just get obsessed with something for a few months and I can't think or learn or read about anything else. Like right now it's broadswords. Don't ask me why. It consumes me, and then I kind of get bored with it and I move on to something else. And that has been this albatross around my neck for most of my life. It has made it hard for me to be productive at the things I'm supposed to be doing until now, where all of a sudden I get paid to like write about whatever the hell that thing was that I got obsessed with, and then I can move on to the next thing. It's true. Honest to God, I'm not being funny. Like, it's a tremendous privilege.
I love it. Well, you do say in this piece, and we're going to get to the heart of the piece, but let me call you out on one sentence. It's not even a full sentence. It's a fragment. You write, "Straight bodybuilding fans," and then parenthetically, "and I remain one, don't ask me why." I'm actually going to take this opportunity to ask you why.
Okay.
Why are you a straight bodybuilding fan?
Well, straight, you'd have to consult my genome.
Okay.
In terms of being a bodybuilder, I think people fall into bodybuilding fandom. I think the most often, frequent way that they do that is the way that I did, which is that you want to start working on your own body. And I'd always sort of lifted a little bit. I had a great lifting coach in high school who was really wonderful and kind of got me started. And then I'd sort of had times in my life where I had a lot of time to dedicate toward it, and then not so much. And then it was when I was living in Boston. I had a really good job, was making pretty good money, and did not have a lot of responsibilities in life at that point. And I went through this period where I was spending a lot of time in the gym, 2 hours a day. Great time. love doing that, and I wanted to just kind of learn more about what I was doing, and so that I could get more serious about it and be better at what I was doing in the gym. And that's when, you know, a generation ago, I would have picked up muscle magazines, and that's how I would have fallen into the world of bodybuilding, down the rabbit hole of bodybuilding. But in the 21st century, it's basically YouTube. You know, you just start watching YouTube videos, you know, Googling, you know, searching, you know, how to do a bench press or something in YouTube, and then you just start to see these dudes, these bodybuilders and they're just peacocks. They're really colorful,
oh, yeah,
interesting characters, and they look super bizarre, and it's really, and that's how you fall into it. You go trying to learn, and then you just kind of get engrossed in the teacher, you know?
Yeah.
And you just sort of get invested in it. And I started watching the competitions and enjoying them. And I don't know, something so hard to explain to other people. And I know it's weird. It's probably one of the weirdest things about me. But like, yeah, when the Mr. Olympia happens every fall, that's like the one sporting event that I watch every year.
Wow.
And there's like a live webcast, and it's on Central Time, and I stay up way, way too late. And I just can't really explain to anyone why I did that, you know, beyond saying what I just said to you. And that was the long version.
Well, one of the sparks in this piece, as I understand it, as I processed your piece, is that former Governor Schwarzenegger had some comments about the current aesthetic put out there by bodybuilders.
Yeah, Schwarzenegger is, you know, it's so funny because he's such a huge presence in American life, and what he has done as an actor and as a politician has, I think, probably really eclipsed the thing that initially made him famous, which was that he was a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
In fact, he is regarded by a lot of people in bodybuilding as the greatest of all time. He was known as the Austrian Oak, and he won the Mr. Olympia competition 7 times, which was a record at the time. That's why we know who Arnold Schwarzenegger is, because he was a bodybuilder.
You wrote in the piece, "Bodybuilding in Arnold's day was undeniably intertwined with gay culture, and early muscle men like Steve Reeves were gay icons. Now, no one but the most ardent muscle fetishist would want to have sex with the cartoon characters who place at Mr. Olympia or the Arnold Classic." And so Arnold had some things to say about this.
Yeah, back in his day, the aesthetic ideal that you were going for as you were altering your body was sort of type of V-shaped body, a V taper in your torso, so that there was a maximum width differential between your shoulders and the narrowest part of your midsection, right? This is, in fact, it all goes back before Arnold to a guy named Eugene Sandow, who's known as the father of modern bodybuilding. He's this turn of the 20th century German guy who actually went into museums and took measurements of Greco-Roman statuary and took that as his model, tried to build his body to those proportions. And that's sort of the path that led to Arnold and the other kind of golden era of bodybuilding types. And, you know, and they, so they were all about kind of creating this V, this, you know, big shoulders, big arms, big chest, small waist. And then, to a certain extent, it's the same inexorable march of bigger, faster, stronger that we see in the rest of the culture at large, and in particular in anything that's athletic. But, you know, the guys just started getting more and more muscular following Arnold's day. And a lot of that was enabled by drugs. You know, Arnold was on steroids. All those guys were on steroids, but that's about all they took. In the 80s and the 90s, rather, other stuff started to creep into the bodybuilder's drug routine, notably human growth hormone. And some weird stuff started to happen, which was that in addition to these guys getting freakishly large, and especially in their legs, you know, Arnold's legs basically looked like mine. Legs today now are often on pro bodybuilders, the width of the individual thigh will be wider than the dude's waist.
Yeah.
Massive, massive thighs. It's insane. Totally inhuman, okay? So they got so big that then these weird things started to happen. Their stomachs started to stick out. And I call it the muscle gut. Some people will just call it sort of clinically abdominal distension. Some people will call it pregnant bodybuilders. But these dudes who are standing up on stage at, 4% body fat, incredibly lean, not an ounce of fat on them, have these guts with abs on top. And it's totally weird and looks terrible. And it's this kind of uncomfortable thing in the room in bodybuilding because no one actually really knows what causes it. Science, as I write in the piece, science has thus far had more important things to study. So all we're left with is what bodybuilders call bro science, which is basically just bros guessing. Sounds sexy, right?
Not
like,
so much.
I mean, am I turning you on, Ken?
Not even remotely.
No, you're loving this. I can tell. So you know what? Do me a favor. Do you have a computer in front of you?
I have it.
People at home can do this along with us. Do a Google image search for Marcus Ruhl. That's R-U-H-L? Yeah.
Okay. How is that not a cartoon? So I'm seeing a cartoon. That's what...
Tell the people what you see.
Okay, so I see kind of like this really distended Hulk-like bronzed guy that it doesn't even look like a real person.
Kind of like a suit, right?
It's kind of like a suit. I pause and I'm a little upset that the first thing I think is, what size shirt does he even wear? That I don't even understand how to work that. And he looks happy, but he also looks like he could keel over at any second.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, is that these guys, the way that you're seeing him there when he's competing, the bodybuilders, they don't look like that year-round. They compete on what's called a bulking and cutting cycle, generally. It's pretty easy to make your body get big and strong if you're not worried about fat accumulation. The male body wants to do that as long as it's, that's how it wants to respond to exercise and lots of food. It wants to get big and strong. What the body doesn't want to do is be extremely muscular and extremely lean at the same time. That's very unnatural. You kind of have to trick your body into doing it. So now that you've seen that, now do a search for Frank Zane. Z-A-N-E.
Yeah, because I can't look at this anymore, because I was previously taught that necks were important, but I'm not seeing that maybe they are in what I'm seeing.
No,
oh,
you're
see?
About to see a neck.
Look at that. Now I'm looking at images of Frank Zane, who's much more of the sleek Adonis, defined muscles. I would say he is much more aesthetically pleasing to me.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm curious about this. Like, is this, so this is for people who are driving and shouldn't be checking this on their
should
phone
not
right
be.
Now.
Yeah.
If this is a guy from, Frank Zane is a guy from Arnold's era, and he would compete at weights like 160 pounds. I mean, really normal adult human male weights. But with phenomenal definition and symmetry and, so this is my question for you, Ken. You look at this guy. Is it still too much for you, or do you want to hit that?
A question that in 302 episodes has never been asked to me on this show. I am much more inclined to, as the kids say, hit that on Frank Zane than I would be on the previous guy, yes.
So this is where we've come in basically a generation, is from Frank Zane to Marcus Ruhl.
Yeah.
And this is, to get back to your original question, this is what Arnold Schwarzenegger is really pissed off about. Arnold Schwarzenegger remains a really important figure in bodybuilding. The second biggest bodybuilding competition of the year, the Arnold Classic, is named for him, and he's a very big presence there. He promotes shows. He's the executive editor of several muscle magazines. He looms very large in the sport. And at the end of this year's Arnold Classic, which was in Columbus, Ohio last month, he basically went on a tirade during a Q&A where he said, I can't get behind what's going on with these physiques anymore. You used to want to have a V-shaped body, and now people have like a bottle-shaped body. It's just disgusting.
Yeah.
And he, called upon the judges to change their judging criteria so that people would start training for beautiful bodies again. And that's what got my attention, is that he used the word beautiful. That's this weird thing about bodybuilding, is that it's so it's so kind of hyper-hetero, it's so sort of insecurely hyper-hetero that no one will, you never hear someone describe a man's body as beautiful,
yeah,
despite the fact that's what this is all about. It's not a strength competition. That's a different sport. Bodybuilding is about making your body look amazing, and that's how you're judged. And no one says that. No one says beautiful. And that got me thinking about, like, why? Why is bodybuilding so desexualized? And that got me onto this whole narrative that has been getting me beat up on the internet all day.
Now, I have to ask you, are you one of these folks, and I already know the answer, so you better be truthful on this one, you do read the comments, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I, much to my wife's chagrin, I read and respond to the comments.
Yes, you do, because your colleague, my buddy Netta Ulaby, has taught me don't look at the comments. But Adam Ragusea,
yeah,
he's not only reading them.
Standard NPR thinking.
Yeah. You are not only reading them, you are responding to them. How would you characterize the tenor? Because from what I've seen of the comments, there is this kind of bro culture, no homo-ish aspect to bodybuilding that are really taking you to task.
Yeah, I mean, because this is the thing. I mean, lots of people have been talking for years about the physiques getting out of control and really gross, and the drug use getting really gross and probably quite dangerous. You know, we just haven't seen, you know, the guys who came up in the drug era in the 90s, we haven't seen how long they're going to live.
Right.
I think some of them with their enlarged hearts and stuff might start dropping dead really soon. But anyway, so people have been talking about it for a while. What I got to thinking about was, why did this happen? Why did bodybuilding go from trying to, you know, carve yourself into a Michelangelo sculpture to trying to make yourself into a circus freak?
Yeah.
And, you know, what I think it's about, well, it's about a lot of things. I mean, but what I think part of what it's about, whether it's conscious or not, is that it's about making this sport, as it calls itself, it's really a beauty pageant, making this sport safe for the target demo, which is young, mostly straight dudes.
Right.
You know, by making the physiques grotesque, you're essentially desexualizing it. You know,
yeah.
And it's all, it's much safer for a young sort of, you know, a young meathead to be admiring of another dude for his freakishness than for his beauty. And again, I don't think that was like a deliberate marketing strategy on the part of the IFBB at any point. But I do think that there's a reason why the sport really started to blow up in terms of popularity and profitability in the 90s as the physique started to get so crazy gross and so distant from the broader culture's aesthetic ideal. You would think that it would sort of become more of a, even lose popularity in that process. But no, it's gotten more and more and more popular. And I think it's because it's made it safer for straight dudes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, bodybuilding was in Arnold's day, it had a whole leg in gay culture. It wasn't all gay, but it had a whole leg in gay culture. Those you know, guys like Frank Zane, Arnold, they were gay icons. There are lots of stories of bodybuilding impresarios basically being older closet cases who would help bodybuilders in their career in exchange for sexual favors. And lots of the bodybuilders made their money on this because, you know, it wasn't until recently that top bodybuilders could make a living doing this stuff. A lot of bodybuilders would make money either being escorts or exotic dancers. And so that was part of it back in the 70s and into the 80s. And now it's just, you know, I'm sure that there are specialists, fetishists out there that are into this, but for the most part, this has been totally desexualized, both in how it looks and also in how people talk about it. If you watch the Mr. Olympia, listen to the color commentary, it's like they just bend over backwards to not describe anything in sexual terms. And that's really tough when it is what it is, which is these dudes in these basically thongs,
right,
you know, oiled and posing and having to show their backsides to the audience. You know, if you want to do another Google image search, Google ripped glutes, GLUTES, yes, ripped glutes. You cannot win a bodybuilding competition anymore unless you diet down to the point where there's no fat left on your ass. And as a result, you get these striations, these lines
Whoa.
In your butt.
Yeah.
And you have to display that to the audience to prove that you have reached that level of leanness. And
oh,
like,
hey, that's not painted on.
No, that's not painted on. But those are some gay pictures, right?
Yeah.
Like, those are some gay pictures, okay? It's just these people have to do such mental gymnastics to kind of not think about what they're seeing as sexual. And I pointed that out, and now a lot of those dudes are kind of, you know, being defensive about it. And, you know, maybe I'm oversimplifying. I'm sure this isn't the only reason why the physiques have gotten so freaky, but I'm pretty sure it's part of the reason.
Yeah, it could be there. It could be there. Again, the name of the piece has Gay Panic Ruined Bodybuilding. Can we hit on just very quickly some Adam Ragusa gay ephemera?
Sure.
Okay, because I would argue, now you have to tell me if I'm wrong, you have certainly elicited comments on any number of pieces, but have you ever seen a reaction like all the comments that went down in the story you filed last year about the gay teacher who filed the sex discrimination claim against the Georgia school?
Oh, f*** me, that one. Flint Dollar. Oh, poor Flint Dollar. Yeah. Well, no, I've had longer comment threads, but that one, it got picked up in, like, the conservative media sphere. It was Newsbusters picked up my report and criticized it, and they did that thing. This is how I knew I had made it. They did that thing where they find a video of you, and then they pull out a freeze frame of your face in an unflattering, you know, like, shape, and then that's their photo for you.
Lovely.
They did that for me. That was awesome. For listeners, Flint Dollar is a Catholic school music school teacher in Macon, Georgia, where I live, and he got let go from his job when his boss became aware of the fact that he was going to go to, I think, Minnesota to marry his partner. And Flint Dollar is not taking that lying down, and he's pursuing some rather novel legal challenges to what happened to him. And I did a story about it for NPR. And, I've really prided myself on, like, trying to engage commenters, because so many people, they go into a comment thread expecting to just kind of spew hate.
Right.
And I love getting in their face. It's like I used to cycle a lot. And when I was really, really in shape as a cyclist, I used to love, when you're out on a road bike, people will harass you. Bros will, like, yell at you or try to scare you off the road or something like that. I used to love when, like, some, you know, college dude would yell something at me on my bike. I would catch up to them. I just put it to the metal, and I'd catch up to them at the next traffic light and I'd just knock on the door. I'd say, get out of the car right now. And they never did. Because it's awesome, because it's like it's the bravery that comes with not having to deal with the human consequences
right.
of your actions,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's why people are so inclined to say, f*** you in a car. We can swear on your podcast, right?
I'll bleep it out, yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
You're good. You're
work.
Good.
That's why people are so inclined to, like, you know, yell at you from a car, is because they're just going to drive away and they don't have to deal with the consequences of that action. Like, the internet is like that. Comment threads are like that. So I really enjoy confounding that. So when people yell a bunch of hate, I get in and say, hey, I'm the guy you're hating.
Right.
Here's actually why I did that.
Right.
And it actually often really results in these really humanizing conversations. You know, it suddenly gets civil, and you learn a lot about the dude and his concerns, and he learns a lot about you and why you did what you did. I often find it to be a really gratifying experience. But, man, that Flint Dollar story, oh, man.
Intense. Oh, then we should be clear. In all fairness, not all the comments were negative. I just have to read you one positive comment from that story. One of the commenters wrote, "The story is factual with no readily apparent bias. Seems like good reporting to me. For example, as a psychologist, I can tell you there is no correlation between pedophilia and sexual preference." And who wrote that comment, Adam?
At least my dad thinks I'm cool. This is awesome. My dad he's just like his whole internet history. He's been Ragusa. That's just his name online, which, you know, made sense back in the day. But now, like, he'll comment on stories that I write, and he'll under the name Ragusa, and he'll forget that, like, most people are going to read that thinking it's me. And it's especially weird when he's, like, praising the story. Or I guess it's even weirder when he's criticizing the story, as he did with today's story. you know? And I have to drop in and I have to say, hey, everybody, just so you know, this is my dad. It isn't me. Hilarious.
I love it. I love it. Well, there's so many other things that we're not going to get to, although I will just give a quick shout out. You do have a YouTube video up there playing perhaps the gayest song of all the songs. It's your arrangement of Believe, originally performed by Cher. And so everybody should go on over to YouTube and see your rendition of that, because it's something to behold, Adam.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, is this weird that I'm so interested in gay things?
No.
Because I am.
No, me too. I'm right there with you, man. So, no, I don't.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I've always been interested in gay culture, in male gay culture. I think I know what it is, actually. It's like I love how men act when they are totally unmitigated by the moderating force of women in their life.
Yeah.
You know, when just dudes are able to be dudes with other dudes and do dudes. Like, and they can just do it all. I mean, just like, they can be so male to the core. Like, I just think that's awesome, you know? And I don't know if it's that I wish I could or would partake in it. It's more just as a spectator, I just enjoy it, you know? It's like, wow, it looks like you're having so much fun. Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I got to tell you, Adam, I enjoy the content that you are putting out to the world so much. Listeners, you guys can follow Adam on Twitter. His handle is aragusia. We will certainly link to it, because we didn't even get to all the stuff. You are doing some really amazing things. I will tell you, as my end of the show praise, you're doing some really great things in this field of journalism, questioning, hey, what is it that we're putting out there? How do people use their authentic voice? There's one episode of The Pub that you've done that's called How Women, People of Color, and Everyone Else Can Sound More Like Themselves on the Radio. And I love these ideas that you are perpetuating and really championing, that there is a lot more work to do in journalism. Journalism as a field is not getting easier, but we can embrace this idea of being like a teaching hospital to support each other and really put great content out there. So folks should know he's not just about share and bodybuilding and, you know, trolling comment sections. He's doing a lot more.
Oh, Ken, you flatter me so much. I'll tell people my basic thesis on journalism, if they want to know, is authenticity is the new authority. Ditch the artifice of trying to look and act and present yourself as though you know everything about what you're writing about, and just be honest. Be yourself. Be your authentic voice. I think that's the way you diffuse most obvious criticisms against you. I think that's the way that you gain audience, and that's something that, Ken, you do here on this show every week brilliantly. You just got to be yourself. There's no point in trying to be anything else these days.
Well, I thank you for that. Hey, I'm going to let you do something that no straight male has ever done on This Show Is So Gay, and that's to say our end tagline. The only two words that you need to know, Adam, are so gay, and you'll know when to say them. Are you game?
I am game.
All right. Well, listeners, thank you guys so much for checking out this week's episode. Our thanks, of course, to singer-songwriter Eli Conley. What a treat to have him on. And you should definitely go check him out on tour, because his music is incredible. And, of course, to Adam Ragusea. Go follow him on Twitter. He's got a turn of phrase that he puts out in the world that just entertains me to no end. You guys, go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you are out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be
so gay?
Rise in the early morning and watch the ocean and the sun. Daybreak, the sailors yawning, they're not expecting anyone. I know the days of storms are yet to be, 'cause the blue horizon never stays with me. I got fever in my bones and blood between my teeth. For every ship that goes down in this plastic coral reef, their souls are bundled up with mine. I know it's just a matter of time till I cut this line. was so easy to outweigh the days and nights, weaving my theory purses, braving those endless eagle fights. I found that as the days roll on,